first speaker this morning is Damianos Karakos from John Hopkins, and he's going to talk about language modeling with the Maximum Likelihood Set.
Thank you. So this is some work that I've been doing mainly with Sanjay Kudanpur, who gave a talk here yesterday. It is a new idea for doing language modeling. So first of all, what is language modeling? So as Fred Jelinek said yesterday, it is a probability assignment to any word sequence. So if we have words W1 through Wm, we want to assign a probability to them, to the word sequence. And as we know, we can write the probability as a product of conditional probabilities. And what is being used currently in practice is the so-called n-gram approximation. So we can say that the probability of a word, given the whole history of words which came before it, it can be written as a probability of the word given only the n minus 1 words before it. Please see the book by Fred Jelinek, Statistical Methods for Speech Recognition, which is a good introduction to statistical methods for natural language processing in general. So why do we need language modeling? First of all, for document categorization. Let's assume we have various categories, like spam versus non-spam. How do we, if we get a new document or an email message, how do we know whether it is one category or the other? We build a language model. We build a language, actually a probability distribution, which tells whether a particular sequence of words belongs to this category or not, whether it has a higher probability under one distribution or a higher probability under the other distribution. Information retrieval. We want to compute the probability of a query given a document, and then we rank all the documents according to this probability. And George Hemstra will talk more about that on Friday. Speech recognition. We have some acoustics, and we try to compute the most likely word sequence. And again, as Fred Jelinek, who just came in and said yesterday, we're trying to maximize this probability, the probability of the word sequence given the acoustics. And this can, of course, can be written this way. And this probability of the word sequence is computed by the language model. So the question is it a hard problem? Usually, people do unigram, bigram, or trigram estimation, so it is essentially a desk estimation problem. So in unigram, we're just trying to find probabilities of just individual words. In bigram, just word given another word, or in trigram, word given to a pair of words. So as you can see, if we have a vocabulary, which is typically the size of 50,000 words, then we can see that as we go to the bigram or to the trigram estimation, the space becomes enormous. For estimating probabilities of this type of size, we need actually trillions of samples in order to be able to say that at least we have at least one sample for each event. So essentially, it is a desk estimation problem from small samples. So how do we solve it? So in general, in density estimation, we have x, which is a random variable, taking values in some set, 1 through k. If p is a true distribution of x, we want to estimate this true distribution from the number of samples x1 through xn. Now, the maximum likelihood estimate is just counts how many times we have seen a particular symbol or word in our training corpus, and then divides by the total number of words that we have seen. The problem with that is that it suffers from data sparseness. That is, most values of it are zero, particularly when the corpus size n is much smaller than the vocabulary size. As we said before, in the bigram of the trigram estimation, the space is of the order of trillions. And essentially, we don't have a trillion word corpus, as far as I know. And of course, zeros are very bad, because especially in speech recognition, if you want to try to recognize a phrase and you've never seen a word, or you assign it a probability of zero, you'll never be able to recognize it correctly. So this immediately corresponds to an error. So how do we solve the data sparseness problem? By smoothing. What's the idea behind smoothing? It's just by taking some mass out of the words or out of the symbols that we have seen in our corpus and giving this mass to the words or symbols that we haven't seen or we have seen once or twice. For example, add-one smoothing. It's a very common smoothing technique. We just add one to all counts. By C sub A, I denote the count of a symbol or a word A. And of course, we have to divide by the appropriate number for normalization. As we can see, if a symbol has a count of zero, then immediately gets a count of one. So all symbols have a non-zero probability. Good Turing estimate is another popular estimator. In this case, we have this formula where now we take again the count of a symbol plus one, but then we multiply with the count of counts. So this essentially says this n sub a plus one means is actually the number of symbols which have count a plus one. I'll show you an example to make this more concrete. Let's assume we have symbols 1 through 10. This is our vocabulary of size 10. And on this row, in this row, we can see how many times each symbol has appeared in our corpus. For example, symbol 10 has appeared 0 times, symbol 9 again 0 times, symbol 1 4 times. Now the count of counts is represented in this row, and we can see that, let's say, symbol 1 gets a count of count 1 because it has a count 4. And how many symbols have count 4? Only 1. So it gets 1. The same for symbol 2. Now symbols 3, 4, 5, and 6 get a count of count 4 because they all have a count of 1 and there are only 4 symbols which have a count of 1. And so on. Now the maximum likelihood estimate will give 0 probability to these symbols because they haven't been seen in the corpus. And similarly for the rest. As you can see, if you count all the counts, actually if you sum them up, it is the sum is 10. So you can make easily the division. The add one smoothing will just add one to all these counts, and we get these probabilities which increase monotonically with the counts. Now good Turing estimator does something interesting. It will give probability 0.1 to those symbols which have been seen 0 times. And curiously, it will give a probability 0.05 to all those which have been seen once. So apparently, it gives more, a high probability to those symbols which have been seen less times, which is actually something that we will discuss later in this talk. So apparently, some estimators like the good Turing and others are inconsistent in that respect.
Oh, that's really
that
was
that wasn't the right thing to
say. Well, zero here.
Yes, there is also a zero because actually there is no symbol with count three. So if you use this formula, you will see that the count of counts of a symbol with count three is zero.
Yeah, but that's a very unnatural distribution.
It's a very unnatural distribution, yes.
But this kind of thing shows up, actually, all over the time when you're trying to use BitTorrent.
Say it again, Jason.
When this problem shows up all the time, having zeros in the numerator, or indeed in the denominator. So,
good warns you against it. And
sure.
There are various ways to derive.
There are various tricks of getting a parametric for through the counts and all kinds of things like that to try to deal with that. On the other slide, actually, because n c sub a is in the denominator, isn't there a problem with the good Turing estimate 0.4? Wouldn't that... I seem to remember that if you try good Turing in the naive way, you end up getting divisions by zero at the level just above you have the zero in the numerator.
So in fact, the symbol with the highest count would get zero probability because there is no symbol with a higher count.
Yeah, but you don't
know. Yeah, so you typically start at 2.
Right.
Okay, anyway.
So
what is typically done, I suppose, is if you go to the next slide, you'd use the estimate for symbols 3 to 10 and you'd do something different for 1 and 2 as soon as you run into trouble.
Right. So in your approach to language modeling, is the maximum likelihood set that was introduced by Zhandinak and Kudanpour in the Journal of Neural Computation in 2005. So the idea is the following, that given some observed counts, the maximum likelihood set will contain all distributions under which the observed counts are more probable than any other set of counts for the same sample size. So let's see what this means. This is the probability simplex in three dimensions. Now, all possible, if we assume that we have a corpus with only three samples, in this case n equals 3, all possible empirical distributions, or otherwise called types, are actually correspond to these points in the simplex. Then the maximum likelihood set is actually this convex polytope which surrounds a particular type. So if we observe, let's say, this empirical distribution, then the maximum likelihood set is this set. If we observe this, then it is this set. So it's like a Voronoi cell, which tessellates the simplex. This is a case of n equals 3. As we go to higher counts, n equals 10, for example, we can see that the all possible types or empirical distributions increases, the number of empirical distributions increases, and therefore the sets shrink because we have to tessellate the whole space. More formally, if we have counts C1 through CK of our vocabulary, the vocabulary has size K, and the sum of all counts is equal to n, we have that the probability of these counts is equal to actually to the multinomial expression. So this is given by the probability, this gives the probability that we observe these counts under some distribution P. And therefore,
I'm sorry, what are the C's? Go back again.
So what if we have
these
K symbols.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. No, just tell me.
Yes, if we have K symbols in our vocabulary,
yeah.
Then we have seen, let's say, symbol 1, C1
counts,
times.
Yes.
These are the counts.
Oh, I see.
So okay. The maximum likelihood set is defined as the set of all probabilities in the simplex for which the probability of the observed counts is at least as likely as the probability of any other set of counts for the same sample size, n. It can be proved that equivalent characterization of the maximum likelihood set is the following. Is the set of all probabilities for which if you take any simple I and any simple j, then they should satisfy this linear inequality. That's why when I showed you this, the previous plot, we can see that all these boundaries are actually linear hyperplanes. So let's see now some properties of the maximum likelihood set. First of all, faithfulness to evidence. If we have two symbols, I and J, and we have seen symbol I less times than symbol J, then all probabilities inside the maximum likelihood set satisfy the property that the probability they assign to I cannot be higher than the probability to symbol J. Another property is that if we have seen a symbol strictly more than zero times, at least once, then for every distribution inside the maximum likelihood set, its probability is strictly greater than zero. So this means that there are inherently smooth probabilities inside the maximum likelihood set.
I thought the original problem was that if CI is zero, is equal to zero, then PI was zero. From the very beginning.
So that's a problem, but we will see that the maximum likelihood set contains
okay.
also.
Okay. So this that point there doesn't.
Yes.
Doesn't show that we.
But
solved
at least
that
it says that we are in the right direction.
Okay.
And actually, to answer your question,
you.
Almost every PMF in the MLS is smooth. So it means that for every distribution inside the set, every symbol or every word will get non-zero probability. And by this, I mean that on the boundaries, we may get such distributions, but we, in general, will see that we don't have such a situation. And finally, every PMF in the maximum likelihood set is a strongly consistent estimate of the true distribution, which means that as we increase the number of samples, then all distributions inside the maximum likelihood set will converge to the true distribution. So the maximum likelihood set shrinks to the true distribution. Now the question is, how do we choose an estimate from the maximum likelihood set? First of all, we can prove that the MLS is a closed convex polygon or polyhedron. Now, if there is a reference distribution Q, for example, one that we would use if we didn't have any data, let's say the uniform distribution, then why don't we choose a distribution from inside the maximum likelihood set, which minimizes the Kullback-Leibler divergence between the distribution and the reference distribution Q? And in this case, as Kudanko has proved in his paper, if we have two symbols, I and J, which have exactly the same counts, so there is equivocal evidence, but in terms of reference distribution, one is more probable than the other, then if we choose in this way our distribution from the MLS, then they will have also the same property. So this means that we are faithful to prior knowledge. In this work, we are more concerned with bigram and trigram estimation. So again, in bigram estimation, we're trying to estimate distributions of a word given another word, in trigram of a word given a pair of words. So essentially, we have a different distribution for every conditioning event. So we have a different maximum likelihood set for its history. By history, I mean actually the conditioning event, or the words which have preceded the work that we are trying to estimate its probability. As we saw before, the MLS has at most V-square constraints.
I'm sorry, I'm not following you.
Yes.
You have a different MLS because you're going to estimate the conditional distribution separately?
That's right. For each conditioning event, we have a different distribution, we have different counts.
Rather than estimating the trigram distribution?
Rather than trying to estimate the joint, yes.
And that's smart?
It has worked for us, and actually it is.
I would have thought that one must, I mean, in the Gauss Turing, for instance, that one takes into account the whole thing. One never estimates the conditional distributions.
Actually,
it's a good doing.
It is not conditional. I think it is conditional in that case.
No.
But what you then do is you do the condition, the joint for the trigram, but then when you come to an unseen trigram, you don't use its trigram probability. You just take the total probability of all the unseen trigrams given by the formula, and then you do some backup.
Okay, but we'll talk about it later. But I thought that it is important to sort of, there could be some particular anomaly for a particular history here that will not fit into the general setup. Okay, I'm sorry.
Actually, I believe that using the MLS, one can solve the conditional problem more easily than taking the whole joint.
And it will be consistent with the other conditionals. That's the point.
What other conditionals? So
well, there are conditionals on the, and there are conditionals on yesterday, Friday.
Okay, so what did the word consistent mean when you said that? It will be consistent with the other conditions. I didn't know what that meant.
I didn't mean it in any mathematical way. I mean it that...
There's some sense that it should be consistent.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah.
So
presumably there's a joint that you make all of those conditions. That's always
the case. Right. It's always the case. But it's not necessarily the same joint as some other. I mean, there's more than one joint.
So what happens is that if you're just interested in consistency in this mathematical way, in the Kolmogorov way, then what this says is you're estimating one conditional density for every history,
right.
And then you can put any marginal on the history that you like, and you'll get a joint that is consistent. I mean, the joint for which these are exactly the conditions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So in that sense, it's not a problem. But I think you do need consistency in some other way, so maybe we should talk about
well, okay.
And also, in terms of computational complexity, this is a solvable problem. Taking the whole trigrams, which is in a huge set, I don't know if it can be solved using a quadratic.
Could you go back very quickly one slide?
Yes.
So I guess what I missed was on the next slide, you say you're going to solve a... what you're trying to avoid doing is solving a lot of convex optimization problems. So I understand what the constraints are. What's the objective? Have you said yet which point within the MLS you're going to pick?
So we are doing this.
The main callback.
So we're trying... I haven't told you yet what is the reference distribution. But once we decide
so
what
you
the
fix it to,
once we fix
and
it,
haven't told us where it comes from.
Then we have to solve this optimization problem. So the Kullback-Leibler divergence is a function which is actually convex. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to minimize a convex function in a convex set. And we know that there are a very very fast algorithms for doing that.
Yeah, the only issue is that this is a convex set defined by least squared constraints.
Yes.
Where B is 50,000.
So the issue now is that we have 50,000 square constraints, and not only that, we have lots of histories.
And you just solve.
So we have to solve thousands of convex optimizations, each of millions of constraints, but we'll see that there are computational savings to make this problem tractable. First of all, if we have seen two symbols, I and J, the same number of times in our corpus, and also they happen to have the same reference distribution probability, then it can be proved that the distribution chosen inside the MLS should satisfy that the two symbols have the same probability. This means that we can collapse words together. So if we have seen two words and they satisfy these two properties, then we can say that it's essentially the same symbol, because in the end they will have the same probability. So this allows us to reduce a vocabulary of size 50,000 to an effective alphabet of size 600. The other source of computational savings is that zero count words do not impose constraints on other unseen words. So as we said, we have O to V square constraints. If we have only seen Z words in our corpus, or under some history, then if we write this as Z square plus 2ZV plus V minus Z square, we can see that this term goes away, because this corresponds to only constraints of unseen words to other unseen words.
Can you put back that?
Yes. So if we have two words, let's say I and J, and both of them have zero counts, then we can see that this essentially means that P of J is greater or equal than zero, which is a trivial constraint. So there are all these constraints for which I and J have CJ and CI equals zero, then essentially we don't have a problem.
And this savings, the one you just mentioned, it's bigger since you're doing it conditionally on each history.
Yes, because essentially under its history, the number of words that we haven't seen is tremendously larger than the ones we have seen. So for example, Z, for the corpus that I will talk about, Z is almost equal to 4 on average. So you can see that from an effective alphabet of 600, we go only to 4. To 4 times, of course, 600, instead of 600 square. That's for bigram estimation. Then it can be proved that the estimate of the conditional PMF has the following backup form. So the distribution under a conditioning history Y has the form that if the bigram or trigram XY has been seen in the data, then we have this P star, which is the estimate inside the MLS, which minimizes the KL divergence, or otherwise has this form, which says that is the minimum of two items, two values, m sub y, which only depends on the history, and it is actually a ceiling on the probabilities, depending on which is the minimum value in the scene counts, and some constant times the Q probability, the reference probability. So if we are able to, let's say, sort all the distributions, or sort all the symbols here on this axis with respect to decreasing Q value, we can see that on the seen set, we can just do our convex optimization, but on the unseen, we just clip all those probabilities which are higher than the ceiling, and then for the rest, we just scale them according to Q. And this actually means that the model complexity is only on the scene set. This is the first time a Baco formula is actually given a proof of why it is useful, because it is used very frequently in language modeling. If one wants to estimate a higher order distribution, then if the counts are zero for a particular trigram or n-gram, then it back off to a distribution to an n-gram of less degrees. So everybody has been doing that, but with no explanation. And this is the first time we give a proof of why a back off formula works. But we actually put a cap on the on the probabilities of very frequent n-grams. We essentially say that those unigrams, which are very frequent.
Well, whose prior said they would be very frequent.
Which are very frequent, yes. So I said unigrams, so which means that they have a prior, which makes them very frequent. So if such unigrams are very frequent, but in a particular history are not very frequent because they haven't been seen, then they shouldn't have a probability which is just a scaled, a version of their unigram, which makes perfect sense. Because all other Baco formulas have this form, but without the cap, without the ceiling. They just multiply with the n minus 1 distribution.
Intuitively, the ones that are very frequent have enormous number of opportunities to show themselves after the history.
Sure.
And if they didn't, there is good reason why they didn't.
Exactly. That's the intuition.
And in fact, you should discriminate against them. Actually,
that's true. So in our experimental results, we have used the Upenribbon corpus, which is part of the Wall Street Journal. For training, we use section 0 to 22, which consists of 1 million words. For testing, we use sections 23 to 24, consists of 100,000 words. For a vocabulary, we have 52,000 words, and for that we included 15,000 unknown words. So essentially, we use the leave-one-out method in order to augment our vocabulary with a number of unseen words. Because in the test set, we don't know how many unseen we have. So what we did is that we took our training text, we left one word out, and then we counted how many times we don't see this word. And then from that, we essentially came up with the number of unseen words, which is equal to the number of words which have seen only once. For reference distributions, we used bigram and trigram Good-Turing, Wittenbell, and Knesset-Nye. And usually, trigram Knesset-Nye, as Fred Jelinek said yesterday, is considered the state of the art right now in language modeling for speech recognition. For evaluation, we use the average log likelihood, which is given by this formula. And one can see that we want to maximize the perplexity, we want to maximize this average log likelihood on the test set. As you can see, I have the number of words in the test set here, which amounts to minimizing the perplexity, which is 2 to the minus the average log likelihood. So we report the total perplexity, which we break down into the perplexity unseen and on the unseen algorithms. So for background estimation, if one uses each one of these models, we get these numbers for the perplexity, and then these numbers correspondingly for the seen and the unseen words. Now the maximum likelihood set gives us these numbers, 411, which is lower than 415 for Bucurie, which is good, and 348, which is better than Wittenbach. But not for Knesset 9, we are still above it. So here by the bold type and the square, I just show you where we are better. So we can see that on the unseen engrams, we are better because we get a perplexity which is lower. Which means that essentially we can estimate the engrams which are unseen better. We give them higher probability. And we will see actually how we can improve the total perplexity as well. For trigram estimation, we have these numbers. And now the MLS gives us this count, this values. And again, here we can see that we are better in terms of good Turing, but not in terms of Wittenbell and Knesset 9. So now the question is, how about we try to expand the MLS? What if it is too restrictive? So maybe the requirement that the set of counts we observed are at least as likely as the ones we didn't is too restrictive. So how can we somehow try to include more distributions in it? So this led to the definition of the high likelihood set. So in this case, we say that the words, the count we observe, should be at least as likely as a fraction of the count of the probability of the counts that we haven't seen for some alpha which is between 0 and 1. So if you put alpha equals 1, this you get the same maximum likelihood set. If you choose an alpha which is equal to 0, immediately you get the whole simplex. So somewhere in between, you just blow up your maximum likelihood set.
Why did you think you needed to expand it rather than contract it?
Oh, because you want to include more distributions there. And somehow, the requirement that you want...
Why do you think that the problem is that you need more distributions?
Well, once you get closer to Q, and Q is beating you.
That's one answer. But actually, it has been proved that... I showed you an explanation, yes, in the slide here, how to pick the alpha. And the idea is the following, that as Kudanpour has shown in his paper, the diameter of the MLS is of the order of 1 over n, where n is the number of samples. By a diameter, I mean the maximum L1 distance between the empirical distribution and any other distribution inside the MLS. Now it can be proved that the rate of shrinkage of the high probability set around the two distribution has this rate, 1 over square root of n. And square root of n, as we know, grows slower than n.
Even I know that.
So this essentially says that if you have a true distribution and you draw a ball around it, then with high probability, the empirical distribution will fall inside this ball if the ball shrinks as 1 over square root of n. But the diameter of the MLS shrinks as 1 over n, so it shrinks much faster. So essentially, the true distribution will not be in it with high probability. So this led us to fatten, let's say, the MLS by a factor of square root of n. And indeed, the experimental results show that for trigram estimation, we are able to beat the modified Knesset 9 and all other distributions. And of course, in the unseen trigrams, we are always better.
Just a general question. When you people, the people who show talks are present, numbers like this, when you do these, your data sets are so large that these kinds of differences are statistically
significant. Actually, Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, this set is not very large.
Okay.
So apparently we need to do bigger
trades. What's the significance of 269 versus 270?
Yeah, it is not.
He's saying exactly.
Yeah, actually, I would say that, especially for wonder rates.
I had a question. Just, I haven't seen this result before. So go back to the previous slide. So do you know how often the MLS is so big that the reference distribution is actually inside it?
Yeah, that's a good question.
What fraction of
by reference, you mean the empirical?
No, the queue from which you're trying to find the closest.
I see.
Because if you make your set big enough, queue will eventually be inside it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, you know, there's nothing to, in other words, then you'll get the same performance as your reference distribution, which in this case happens to be the modified connector 9.
Right, so if you set alpha to 0, we know what this table is going to look like.
Yeah, exactly. And alpha equals 0, right. The second box is the same as the first. So how often does it happen that we are just...
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't computed that.
Have you told us where you got Q? Where Q came from?
Oh, sorry, yeah, he actually mentioned it. Q is actually, in this case, it's the good Turing.
Right.
In
so
this case,
Q is whatever the other guys do. Whatever the competition does is Q.
Yeah, I see.
So we are taking a language model and we are making it better.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Makes sense.
Yes.
Now, when you put the calibration slide up before, I was guessing that the Q that you would pick would be the Backoff distribution.
Actually,
and I wonder how well you would do if you tried that.
It turns out to be the backoff, because we only use it for the... Yeah, actually, it is not the backoff.
No, I mean actually to run this recursively. So from the queue for... When we're doing this method for the bigram, for the trigram,
sure.
That queue would be the result of applying this method to the bigram. And for that, queue would be the result of applying this method to the unigram. And for that, the Q would be the uniform.
Yes, actually, we had tried that sometime
is it
earlier,
terrible?
And I remember it was not that good.
So this method doesn't stand on its own. It needs to be parasitic on this scenario.
I'm just commenting on your vocabulary.
The good thing actually is that we still need to try it on more data, more training data, and then we will see bigger differences here.
There is something else though which happens which is interesting, which is that where do you rely on your queue? The queue of course shows up in the minimization itself and what the star you pick. But it shows up more explicitly in the backing off part of your answer. Right, it shows up explicitly as lambda times Q.
Mm-hmm.
And because the Nasser Nye was estimated on the same data, it is really backing off to a bigram when trying to compute a trigram probability anyway. In other words, your Q is internally backing off anyway. So I think we did one set of experiments where we said, let's use just the backing off distribution as your Q.
Yes.
And there the performance is only slightly worse. I think it's within shouting.
Yeah, you cannot claim any significance.
Yeah.
So I wonder, what would happen if inside Knesset or not you backed off to this estimate? So the two were sort of interleaved.
I didn't.
Of course, one would like to interpolate the two eventually for speech recognition. Once you have a good model which performs as well as the other, then interpolating the two should help even better, as long as they are not equal. And finally, for border rates, again, we are getting better. But again, as we said before, this is not a significant improvement because we have a very small training set. Now for unfaithfulness to evidence. We can see that other models like the Knesset-Nye or the Wittenbell are not faithful to evidence. And by these plots, I actually show you the percentage of histories which are not consistent. By inconsistent histories, I mean that it assigns more a higher probability to a symbol which has been seen less time than some other symbol. So here I have a history count which actually says how many times we have seen a particular history in our training data. And here we can see the percentage of all these histories of a particular count, which are inconsistent. And we can see that almost all of them are. And essentially for Knesset 9, within Belen, for Bukurin, we have the same plots, very similar plots. So at least the maximum likelihood set contains distributions which are equally good to the other distributions, but they don't suffer from this problem. They are not unfaithful to evidence. So to conclude, the maximum likelihood set contains good distributions, both in terms of perplexity and in terms of faithfulness to evidence. When the criterion is the minimization of KL divergence, then we can estimate and improve the reference distribution, especially the prediction of anonymous, by placing the ceiling on the probability of very frequent unigrams. And for future directions, we would like to scale into more data. For example, we have some training data of hundreds of millions of words. And measure the performance in other tasks, like in machine translation. And of course, find other ways of incorporating linguistic knowledge through the reference distribution.